Hello, and welcome to another episode of Downtime with the Cranston Public Library. We're a podcast for cool people who love libraries, where we talk about what we've been reading, what we've been watching, and what we've been loving. I'm your host, Taylor, and the branch librarian at the Oaklawn Branch Library, and my pronouns are she, her.
Hi, my name's Elena. I'm a youth services librarian here at the Central Library, and I use she, her pronouns.
Hi, I'm Angela Daniels. I am a middle school librarian at a small independent school in upstate New York, and I use she, her pronouns as well.
All right. Thank you both for joining us. You are both current members of the ALA Emerging Leaders Cohort for 2024. So a little bit later in the show, we will talk about your experience with that and how it kind of kicked off at the beginning of this year. But before we get into that, let's start off as we always do with what have you been reading?
I've been slowly getting through a poetry collection called All the Odes by Pablo Neruda, who I believe is the most translated author in North America, most known for like his romance poetry. I grew up always wanting to be a writer, but my mom grew up always wanting to be a poet. And so I would see her like scribbling on pieces of paper and like shoving them into other notebooks, but she never shared them with me. But my mom is turning, I think, 49 next month, and she lives 7 hours away from me. So I wanted to give her something that felt collaborative. So I got her a bilingual version of All the Odes. And so I'm annotating all the poems that are in English with all my favorite lines and parts that remind me of her or things that I think she might enjoy. And then I'm going to mail it to her. And I don't know if she'll read it in English and or Spanish. I'm not sure. It's up to her. It doesn't matter. Or she could never read it. I don't know. Love you, Mom. But that's what I've been reading. And it's like 800 pages. It's so long.
That's really sweet.
Thank you. Every time I give someone a book, like a chapter book at least, I always annotate it a little bit because I'm a bit selfish.
Oh, I love that. I think that's fantastic.
Thank you.
So I've been reading award winners because I am a middle school librarian, so I read a lot of YA and a lot of like graphic novels. And yeah, so for YA, I've been loving Daniel Nayeri lately. You know, his new one is... Oh gosh, it's like the Seven Assassins of somebody. It's really long, but it's great. And it takes place in like the 11th century. And it's this kind of con man and his kind of servant that he sort of adopts along the way. And it's kind of the story of how they become friends over the course of avoiding all of these assassins. And there's a twist at the end, and I don't want to ruin that for anyone. But I'm reading Trust by Hernan Diaz, I think, which was the Pulitzer in, I think, 22. And I just started it, but it feels a little bit like Gatsby. It starts in kind of the beginning of the 20th century, and it kind of follows this family that are kind of scions of society. So far I really like it. And I'm also reading Girl, Woman, Other by Bernadine Evarista, which I'm a third of the way through and I really love it. It's all these different Black women in Britain at different ages and different stages and, you know, different sexualities and just different experiences and kind of how they intersect. So that's the other thing that I'm reading right now.
I have a book group here, and when it first started, it was called Girl, Woman, Other, because I was running it with another part-time librarian that was here. And we were like, what are we going to call it? And I just like saw it on the bottom of my shelf and I was like, that's perfect. That's exactly like what we want to read about. And now we've shortened the book group name to The Other Book Group because it's just about the othering of people. But that was the first book we read for it. We're like, this book embodies like everything we're trying to focus on theme-wise and all that. Yeah, no, that book is brilliant. Love it.
Well, and I will say, like, I'm at this part that's a lot of the 19-year-old, and she's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm also like, yeah, because at 19, like, you know all the things, and you're kind of insufferable. And I'm like, so actually, she's driving me nuts because she's beautifully written. But I really love that just, like, all these different experiences and stories weaving together.
That's, yeah, that book is like 300 pages of pain sometimes, but in the best way possible, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It could so easily feel like overwhelming or just like mishmash or mixing the characters, but Bernadine, she finds a way to just really like perfectly pace it. They're all so different.
Yeah, I think so.
I love her. It's all you, Taylor.
Yeah, sorry, I was thinking I'm a big Western graphic novel person, but I don't have a ton of experience with manga, and I would be lying if I said that I wasn't like a little bit intimidated by it. It's just like a lot of skills that I have to learn when I read manga, but I am, which I've mentioned on the show before, I'm part of the features team for the review site No Fly No Tights. So we put together monthly lists based on a theme, and finally we had a list that it was all about manga, so I could not avoid reading manga to contribute to this list. It was about mangas that are done in one volume. Yeah, it's a real thing that people want, but it can sometimes be hard to find when, like, so much of the manga market is like these long-running series that have tons and tons of volumes and are harder to get into. So one of the ones that I read for that list was called I Had That Same Dream Again. I don't remember the author off the top of my head, but they're the same author who wrote I Want to Eat Your Pancreas, which sounds really grim, but it was actually a like slice of life one about someone who has a chronic illness related to their pancreas. But I Had the Same Dream Again, I did read, and it's all about this young elementary school girl who has like these kind of like untraditional companions in her life. Like, she doesn't really relate to anyone at school. So she's friends with this woman in her like late 20s, early 30s, who lives by herself, and who they describe as sells her youth, which I'm not exactly sure like what flavor of sex work that's supposed to allude to, but
I mean, in manga, she could literally be selling her youth. That might be exactly what she's doing.
That's fair. But there's also a whole thing of that someone wrote skank where her name should be at her apartment building. And so this little girl calls her Skank-san because, like, she thinks that's her name. So that and the selling her youth makes me think that it is, something related to sex work, but I don't know exactly. They never get into it because the perspective of the book is from a girl who's like in fifth grade, and she never really figures it out. So that's one of her friends. She's also befriended this older woman who lives alone, who's kind of like a grandmotherly figure in her life. And she goes and visits all these people after school because both her parents work a lot and work late. So she kind of like spends after school with one of these like weird companions. And over the course of the book, she also meets a teenager who self-harms. She catches her in the middle of self-harming by herself in an abandoned building. But she finds out that she's a writer and like that she wants to be a writer with this. She grows up and that she wrote a story. It is very literary in a sense that like towards the end, you're kind of unsure what was real and what was like a literary device in order for this main character to like have this journey. That journey being that she has an assignment in school to figure out what happiness is. And so she ends up going to all of these people in her life and kind of asking them about what they think happiness is in an attempt to try to figure it out. I don't want to spoil the like somewhat weird ending too much. I thought it was very interesting how literary it was in the way of like, it felt like a lot of things were more of like a device than actually literally happening.
Yeah. I'm always a little bit surprised how much we're in middle school. So my kids are 6th through 8th grade, 11 to 14, give or take. And they really love those slice of life, like a little bit different version of reality kind of manga. I always, I have a group that will always like go for the, the Pokemon and the battles and the all the crazy stuff. But there's a really big chunk of kids that really identify with exploring a different version of their own reality.
I feel like you would like this, Taylor, because it is a little bit longer. It's not standalone. I have beef with standalone manga, so props to the children who are really enjoying them. But it's never quite, I never feel like all the themes that are brought up in conversations are really given the opportunity to be properly fleshed out. I love me like a 3 to 4 mini series manga one, but there's one called Blue Giant, but I could be wrong. Do you know what I'm talking about, Angela? It's a high schooler and he's just all of a sudden discovered this like love for the trombone and he's not very good at it, but like he's got a different interesting sound. The manga is like gigantic. Like they sell it now like in an omnibus.
Does he play the saxophone?
Is it the saxophone? Okay, there we go. I remember being some type of wind instrument. And he just goes to this park all the time. And he just stands at the top of the hill. And he just like plays it and it sounds like garbage, but everyone's like, he's just so passionate about it. As a like avid manga reader, I have to read it. And it ended up being like, to me, one of the most brilliant pieces of manga I've ever read. And it's, yeah, it's just a slice of life. I mean, how many times can you read about a teen going to the top of the hill playing terribly? But it turns out I can every day.
Well, every day. There's so much power in that, though, recognizing this is not, this isn't magic. This isn't fantasy. This is something that that I could do. This is an outside of my experience. And I think there's a lot of power in that. I will say, though, I'm the same way, because the manga, like, it tells, you know, they tend to tell these stories over these big, long chunks. And so when I get a kid that finds manga they love, they get so mad at me when they end.
Or when they're still coming out.
Yeah, when they run out of books. You know, like, I have a couple of kids who very intentionally choose manga because they'll find a series that will go, they know it goes for 40 volumes. So they know that they find characters that they love and stories that they love, and then they can stay with it.
It's the best.
I don't know if my attention span is that long, but I think especially for teenagers, I think sometimes too, it's overwhelming. You know, all the literature and stuff that we have available for them. For some kids, that's just a lot. So if they can find characters and find a story that they want to stick with for a minute, a lot of teenagers really love that.
And they're kind of epic. I mean, like for Demon Slayer, a battle could last like three volumes. It's bonkers. I'm like, whoa, how many times can you spin with fire? That's incredible. It's so awesome. Yeah. I'm there. Hey, I'm sat. I am sat and I'm here and engaged and listening. So I get it.
Well, I have a math teacher that really loves manga, and she'll come in and she's just all bent out of shape because so-and-so died or a student ruined it for her. I have a student that will spoil it for her. Well, and the student is, she's a new language learner. They moved from China not very long ago. So she doesn't understand like that social interaction. And so she thinks she's helping. So she's like, oh, he's going to die in the next episode. She's like, stop. She's like, can you please explain spoiling to her? She doesn't understand. Because they're ahead in China. They have a couple more episodes that are out that aren't out in English yet. And she's like, she's always ahead. She always wins. But yeah, it's a whole problem because she just keeps spoiling it.
Devastating.
She's like, give me something else for a while. We got to wait till she understands this.
That makes me also wonder if like the idea of spoilers is like different in different cultures.
Yeah, we can't tell if it's because she's 11 or if it's because there's a cultural difference.
Yeah.
Because she's so excited to tell her. And I think too for her, I think she's so excited to have a cultural touchstone that matches, you know, this thing that she brought with her. So I think that's part of it too. I think she's really excited, but I don't know. I don't know if it's a cultural difference or if it's just 11.
Yeah, no, that's true. But besides reading, have either of you been watching anything interesting lately?
Okay. So I watched a murder mystery called Deadlock. I think it's on Prime. And it's Australian, and it takes place in Tasmania, which is like, we lived in Australia for a while. So like Tasmania is this island off the southwest, and it's pretty like, there's not any huge cities. It's pretty remote. And this town over time has become kind of this, they got a female mayor at some point, and over time it's kind of become this haven for lesbians. So like everybody in town in any position of power is a woman, and they have this detective who, had something happen on the mainland, and in the aftermath, she and her wife moved to Tasmania so that she could have less of a crazy pace of life. And so these murders start happening in this town, but it's only men who are being murdered. And it kind of flips that whole thing on its head. Cause it, like at one point the men are like, we don't feel safe in this town. And like, it's just very tongue in cheek, but it's played very, it's played very straight, and they bring over this, you know, they're like, well, you won't have to worry about it. We're going to bring over this detective from the mainland, but they send over this other detective who's just a disaster. She's also a woman, and they have to figure out how to work together to solve these mysteries, you know, these murders in this town. And it's very dry, but I laughed so hard. And it's a little bit of, you know, sometimes it's a little pandering, and I didn't care, but like they really played hard on the, like the men don't feel safe and the men are being targeted. I couldn't not find it delightful. Like, and the men were, you know, really bent out of shape because they didn't hold any leadership in the town. And how could it be fair if they didn't? Like, and in the background, they're holding this like lesbian festival that's like kind of witchy. And so there's all these like really weird like art and like installations and these really strange like dinners and stuff that are really like out there. They're kind of the backdrop for all these murders. And it's, I really got a kick out of it.
I have to see that. I support the message.
It's great.
The kind of like flipping of the gender roles makes me think of the graphic novel Woman world.
Oh,
So like in that one, no men are around, kind of in like a similar plague to like Why the Last Man, but like funny and light. So there are kids that don't remember men at all, because like this happened like when they were really little. And so I remember like some of the kids come upon like a giant pile of disposable razors, and they're just like, what is this for? Because like kind of the premise being that like that, you know, women grooming their body hair is like mostly for men.
Yeah.
So like when you were talking, it made me think of this, of like people who can like can't even comprehend things that were in place because of the patriarchy.
Well, and they really play with it. Like there's a scene where it opens and it's all these women's bodies lying naked on a beach, and you kind of go, oh no, like it's pretty early in the series, so you think, oh no, they've died. And then one of them sits up and it's this art installation that's part of this festival, and they're doing an art piece. So it like plays with that, like finding a body on the beach, but it's never, all the victims are men, and like how quickly they just completely devolve into chaos because they can't handle it.
Love it.
I really got a kick out of it, and everyone should watch it.
Yeah, that sounds great. What about you, Elena?
My turn.
Yes.
I haven't really been watching too much TV, because anytime I watch TV or movie, I end up crying. And like, that's not what I'm here for in this life right now. Just like, why do I love or hate things? I don't know. So I, like a lot of people, I feel like of my generation especially, are watching podcasts. I don't often actually sit down and listen to them. So I've been listening to two drag queens, The Bold and the Beautiful. That's Trixie and Katya's podcast. They're my presidents, my queens. Love them. Who else? Just like TMG, that's the Tiny Meat Gang. They came from back. Those are two guys that were really big Vine stars and have like this phenomenal banter. Random Order Show, which is another group of Vine stars. I just love men from Vine. I think I was like, that was like peak manhood. Like I just love them. They're so funny. Podcasts where people are just laughing because they think they're so funny. I'm like, wait, you are funny. I don't know anything. You're funny. You're so smart. Brittany Broski is like famous for being the kombucha girl on TikTok, I guess. Yes. And she's only a year older than me, and she just understands my entire life. Her whole thing is like, if I cannot daydream about this fictional man, I'll chew my arm off. Like, it's really simple. And she's always like, I'm done. She's so funny. Yeah, I just like really love the truly. I wish I could come to you and be like, yeah, I'm listening to some like affirmational self-help podcast, like politics, true crime. No, it really is like people in a room losing their mind and they're putting it on a platform. And I'm like, girl, same.
No, I'm only listening. Well, mine are mostly true crime, but I need the ones that make it not so like heavy. But that's really interesting to me because I've never watched, like, I know a couple of the podcasts I listen to record, and they're always like, oh, you can, I've never watched podcasts, not once.
You have to. It's so funny. It is so funny, dude. Because even like, I was listening to one driving on the way to work, and one of their guests was like, found out one of the like host was vegan. And he turned to her, he was like, I can't believe you would hold that from me. And it was just like such a long pause. He's like, I don't hate you. I just think of you differently. And they're like, well, we'll talk about it later. He was like, oh great, Britt's gonna hit me later. And I was like, oh my god. Otherwise, I'm just like sitting there in silence. I'm like, what's going on? But then I get to see their face, and I'm like, no, same. Yeah.
Have you ever listened to Oh No, Ross and Carrie?
No, I'll write it down.
It's great. So they've been on forever, like probably close to 15 years now, a really long time. Anybody who makes claims, they'll try it and see. So like they joined Mormonism once, and they joined Scientology. And now like every year for at the end of the year, they'll have like psychics make predictions for the year. And then at the end of the year, they like check up, you know, but they'll join anything. So like they are certified to like get demons out of your house. And like,
they're my people.
Yeah. And they're just like kind of normal people. Like she's a writer in LA. He's an animator for Disney, but they take this very, I think they both grew up pretty religious, and they take this very logical. They're like, hey, we'll give it a try. Like, you're making claims. We'll try it out and see if it really works in practice. And they tend to try to be really respectful of people's views. And they, like, you know, they're 12, 13 years in now. So at this point, they're into some really fringe stuff, and they're still trying really hard to be respectful. They'll let people come on and defend their position and defend their practices. But they, you know, they did ayahuasca in Brazil, and like the fire walking, like all that stuff. They'll try it, and then they quantify their results. And they're funny and clever, but it's a really interesting kind of view into our society and all these like kind of fringy things that are happening that sort of end up all weaving together. So that one's a fun one too.
I love it. I absolutely admire people who basically create their own bingo cards.
Yeah.
And that's how I want to be. I spent my 25th birthday at Nickelodeon Universe by myself in New Jersey. I was like, what am I going to wait for other people for?
You don't have to.
Exactly. A couple of weeks ago, I went to go see Monster Jam. Hey, babe, I'm a monster truck girl. Monster trucks are for girls, okay? I literally have a collection of them in my apartment. What business do I have? Like, I brought my monster truck in the other day because it's remote control, and I showed it to my coworkers, and I drove it around my department. Like,
there's probably programming you could make work around that.
I'm going to have a monster truck program on Saturday.
I love that, and I'm jealous.
Bringing up podcasts did make me think of this one called the Fantasy Fangirls podcast, and this episode was specifically about all their fan theories about the Empyrean series of Fourthwing and Iron Flame. They were like, we've already talked 50 hours about this book series in our breakdowns.
As they should.
Yeah, and they were like, but you don't need to listen to that to listen to this episode. And I don't even remember how I found this episode, but the title is Spoiler Alerts for Fourthwing/Iron Flame. So I'm putting that out there now. And Angela, if you don't want spoilers, I will just skip this whole bit.
It's fine. It's not going to hurt my feelings.
Okay.
I'm less worried about it than the math teacher.
It said Violet's second signet and like our top three choices. And they literally went through like the 20 theories that the whole fandom has been talking about, about what Violet's second signet's going to be because she bonded two dragons.
Yep.
So that like filled the void in my life, that finishing Iron Flame and having no idea when the third book is going to come out. Like the ending, which I already said in the podcast, the ending, I was just like, where are we going to go from here? I'm so emotional.
I was going to throw fists. I was like, excuse me, stop being a coward. Like, just kill people off. I despise when they don't want to take people, like slaying them. It's okay. I don't mind losing beloved characters. I'm so down. Ruin my life.
They're only precious if they can die. Like if you know they're safe, then it's not as fun.
It originally, I think, was a duology, and then she extended it out to, what, like 5 books now? I'm like, okay, we've got plenty of time.
Oh, is that the plan?
Yeah.
I keep needing to look into this because I read these books and then was just like, oh my God, I'm so obsessed with these books, but then like did not engage in the fandom that much.
Oh, you silly duck.
So if anyone knows, downtime@cranstonlibrary.org, if anyone knows where the good Fourthwing fanfiction is, please let me know, because Archive of Our Own apparently is not where it's at.
Yep.
I haven't really dug that deep, but like the tags I usually check, it's like nothing's here. And I'm like,
you know, they have their own cave somewhere.
Yeah. I just got to find it, I guess. But there's part of me that was like, am I going to have to be the person to do this? Am I going to have to be the change I need to see in the world?
That's so bold.
Maybe you do. Maybe that's what needs to happen.
I had to clap.
I've written fan fiction before. It's been a hot minute, but I did it in the height of my Daredevil fangirl.
Wow.
I mean, maybe that's programming. You need like a fanfiction programming thing at your library.
Word. I had to applaud when you said like, where's the fanfic? Because I want to know too. I'm almost so desperate that I'm about to read ACOTAR. I'm scared.
I mean, that's been on my list kind of for a while. Mm-hmm. But I just like, I don't know. I just never got into it. It seems like a very long fantasy series at this point.
Yeah.
Like she's not done writing it, right?
No, she's still going.
Yeah. So this part of me that feels like if she's not done, even though I have way more books than just the two with Iron Wig, but it's like, if she's not done, I don't know if I can have that many series that aren't done in my life.
That's why I haven't started those, because like, I can't get halfway through and then be like, oh, now who knows when. I can't do that. I'll wait.
Yeah.
I'll just wait till she's done, because I'm not down with that.
Mm-hmm.
I read the Murderbot Diaries. Have you guys read those?
I haven't, but Dave Mm-mm. has, so I'm sure he's very happy.
Oh, they're fantastic. But it's the same thing. Like, I blow them through all of them and I'm like, okay, just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I can't even start that one, because I'm like, I won't even get, like, the story's not even half over. I can't. I have to wait till she's got a little more in there for me. I need to be able to be kept busy longer than that, or I'm going to be mad.
I agree. That's how I am with all my series, basically. I'm like, what's the point?
Let me know when you're done. I'll be in.
Yeah.
When I can buy the complete box set, I will participate.
Exactly.
That's how my partner is, too. So, like, he read Wheel of Time, because, like, that's been done for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah. But for a long time, it was not done.
No, that's true.
Because I'm old. Like, I remember when Wheel of Time was still coming out, and those books were so long, and it was, like, very much the kind of Game of Thrones thing, where it's, like, years and years. So yep. I did the same thing. I got about halfway through, and I was like, I just can't. It takes too long.
Mm-hmm. Unreal.
Yeah, I think that happened to my mom with Game of Thrones. Like, someone gifted the first Game of Thrones to her. Like, when it first came out, she was like, you were a baby, and someone gave me this book.
And it's still not done.
Yeah, and she was like, I read it, and then I realized that, like, there was a bunch more, but it wasn't done.
Yeah, I got, like, three in, and it's hard. Like, there's a lot of, you know, violence against women and stuff. And I'm like, okay, but if we get redemption, but I don't know if you get redemption, because at the time, there were still three more books. And I'm like, I can't.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll revisit it when he's done, which may never happen.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I had a patron keep asking me, like, is Winds of Winter out yet? And I, like, babe. I think at one point I said to her, this is my personal opinion, but I don't think he's gonna finish these books.
I don't think he's mm-hmm. doing it,
especially with how much the fandom has a bad taste in their mouth from the show,
mm-hmm.
from the ending of the original show. So far, House of Dragons has been fantastic. And I'm excited for more of that. But I think just like culturally, everyone's just like, we're done with this fandom.
Well, and if he wanted to save it, that was the time to swoop in.
Yeah. Mm. But then he didn't.
He may have missed his window. Yeah. I don't know. I think he's making it up. I don't think he's been writing a book ever. I think he retired 5 years ago and just didn't want to tell anybody.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I'm totally working on it. Any minute. It's totally coming.
Because he was working on other stuff.
Yeah, other stuff has come out.
Sometimes patrons would get frustrated because they would be like, he wrote this sci-fi book. And I was like, I fully understand. I know.
Correct. Here's the address you write that complaint letter to.
Yeah. He wrote the prequel. He did. He 100% did. Yeah. I understand.
And right now he's writing something totally different, unrelated.
Yep.
And we'll return to the show after a quick break.
Did you know that you can borrow everyday household tools or educational materials from the library? Got a home improvement project that needs doing? Borrow a level, stud finder, or outlet voltage tester? Looking to supplement your child's learning at home? Borrow one of our school toolkits, like a microscope, toy cash register, robots, and more. Feeling musical? Borrow a ukulele and instruction book from our Oaklawn Branch Library. To find the full list of items and where you can go to borrow them, go to cranstonlibrary.org/cool-tools or cranstonlibrary.org/school-tools for educational materials. Users of Cranston Public Library can now access their favorite digital magazines using Flipster. Flipster offers an easy, browsable reading experience. Users can browse magazines by category as well as perform searches for specific titles. An online newsstand provides a carousel of most recent issues as well as a carousel of all issues, allowing for quick access to magazines. Go to cranstonlibrary.org to find more information on how you can access Flipster. Flipster also has an app available on Android and iOS. All right. Well, we, as three librarians together in one room, we talked a lot about a lot of nerdy stuff, but I wanted to make sure we get to the emerging leaders. So I guess first and foremost, explain to our audience what the American Library Association Emerging Leaders Program is.
Well, it is a program, a 6-month program, basically, that accepts roughly, 44 to 50 people a year. We're all basically brand new librarians. They ask for you to have, 1 to 5 years.
Less than 5 years in practice.
Yeah, less than 5 years. Yep. Yeah, and we submit an application. It's as simple as, what are you passionate about? What are projects that you've done? It was simple, just basic stuff, trying to get to know you as a librarian, where you stand and what you've done thus far in your career. And then we get selected, and then we get to go to LibLearnX, which was in January, and we meet each other. We meet everyone in our groups, everyone in our program, and we find out more about our project. We work on that project for the next 6 months together as a team. I'm assuming all the groups are 5 people, right? That looks right to us.
I think they're all 4 or 5 people.
Lovely. Yeah, we work on that, and then we create a beautiful little poster. And we bring it to California this June to ALA, the big, massive conference.
Well, and I think the idea is that it's a way to kind of expose some of the newer librarians to the organization of the ALA and leadership opportunities within the ALA. So they're kind of trying to give us an opportunity to interact with some of those different groups and committees and all of those things.
Mm-hmm. I had an opportunity to go with my director, and he's very active in ALA Council. So anytime I'd kind of go to the meeting, he'd bring me around to introduce people, and he'd always do his same spiel of Elena's been working with us for a long time. She did library school here. She works in the city she grew up in. Blah, that whole thing, the whole gig, And he would always end it each time being like, oh, and she's a 2024 emerging leader. And they were locked in. They were absolutely locked in. Be like, oh, really? Okay, what are you interested in afterward? What type of committees do you want to join? Here's my business card. I'll see your poster and we'll talk afterward. So it's a good opportunity for us to be able to do national work. If you want to be a mover and shaker, this is a nice stepping stone for us to get into that.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with the Library Journal Movers and Shakers, which is a completely different new librarian award kind of program. I just felt like I had to say it.
It's a show of all librarians. There might be a little bit of inside baseball.
Mm-hmm.
So you both are working on the same project. Can you talk a little bit about your project?
So we are working on the philanthropy work group. So the ALA is a nonprofit and has been for a long time, but they've only really looked at fundraising as a function in the last 5-10 years. And they haven't actually had a fundraising arm per se. They've subsisted on some donations and a lot of grant funding rather than private donors and those kind of things. So I think, and Elena, if you understand this differently, feel free to jump in, but they're kind of coming to us saying, hey, take a look at who our donors are and see if you can help us kind of identify some donor segments we're not reaching and kind of help us take a look at what we've done so far that is working and we might adjust and who we're missing. So we're part of what we're doing is we're going to talk to people who are currently working on these committees and in this space within ALA and see how they feel about it. And then we're going to go out into our own library communities. In my experience, a lot of people, speaking of inside baseball, a lot of people outside of librarianship don't know what the ALA is or what it does. I more than once have heard someone say, oh, the ALA bans books. I'm like, 100% the opposite. We are exactly the opposite of that. But they get ALA and banned books in their head and they don't know who we are, or what we do. And I think a lot of people in this current political and cultural climate would probably be very interested in supporting a lot of what we do if they understood what we do and how to help. So that's what we're doing. We're kind of evaluating who they're reaching really well and who they're not reaching and trying to help them start thinking about how do you reach out to those groups of people.
Perfectly said.
I think that's a good point, especially in the recent current political climate, everyone who is outside of libraries who is aware that the ALA exists, has misinformation about the ALA.
Right.
Some of the things that have led state library organizations to leave ALA is public outcry from their constituents about the ALA based on things that are not true, like that the ALA is using federal funds to do X, Y, and Z thing, all kinds of stuff. So I think it is important for more people who are, especially people who are on the side of intellectual freedom and freedom to read, to understand what ALA is doing.
Well, and just how ALA supports your local library. You know, like every librarian you interact with, like at least in New York State, every librarian we interact with, like we get support from ALA. We get, you know, like our local libraries are getting funding. And if we had a book challenge lawsuit, that's a place we could go for funding. But like I said, you know, the people who have said that to me are people who should know better. And they're people who might be in that donor pool if they understood what the ALA does. But even if you go to the ALA website as a librarian, it makes perfect sense and you can figure it out. But I think it took us 4 or 5 clicks to get to a place where we could donate, you know, and there's not really a bullet point of here's what we're doing in your community. You know, it is very much designed for its main audience, which is librarians. But how do we then communicate that work to other people? Because like I said, you know, we kind of talked about every person is a patron of the ALA. They just don't know it.
Yeah. And the ALA is like setting all of our guidelines, even if like your particular library's funding streams are coming from
various funding streams.
Like the ALA ALA's policy and procedures in terms of like their recommendations for how libraries should function probably informs some policy at your local library, if not all of them.
Absolutely. Well, like I'm a sole contributor in my library. I'm the only librarian in the building. I don't have an aide. I never will. And nobody else in the building does what I do. So like I wrote all my own policies and I started at the ALA's website, like, cause they have sample policies and start with this and think about this. And so, you know, there's lots of that going on. I don't know that like Joe Schmo on the street cares a lot about that, but he does care about the policy that I wrote about book challenges.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They care when it indicates what things we should be buying. And I don't want to say shouldn't be buying in like a censorship way, because that's not what I mean, but just like what is inside of our collection's purview and what is not.
Right. Well, and just what informs that? How many times when you see a book ban and they start talking to the person who's requested it, they haven't read the book, like most of the time. Knowledge is power. So understanding the ideas and the thoughts behind collection development and what those policies are there for and why goes a long way. Because, you know, I mean, if the stats come out all the time, but the vast majority of Americans are not comfortable with this level of censorship and don't support it. What is it they say? I think it's, if this stat is wrong and you hear this on a podcast and you know it's wrong, I'm doing my best. But something like 85% or something of all book challenges in the United States today can be traced to like 7 people.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those times when it looks like a bunch of people are really upset about a thing, but it isn't. But the people who aren't inside baseball and who aren't in the know don't know the difference if we don't help them know. If we don't argue our side, if we don't give them all of the information, which is kind of our whole thing, you know, our whole thing is you should be able to get whatever information you want. So let's make sure they have the information about the most basic things that we do.
And even thinking locally, and I'm aware of this personally because I'm the chair of our state's Intellectual Freedom Committee, all of the fuss that has been raised in our state about genderqueer came from 2 people.
Do they live in your state?
Oh, yeah. They live in our state, but neither of them had children in the schools that they brought complaints to.
Wow.
So based on that, my policy and based on the recommendations of the ALA, my policy does not allow you to challenge a book in my building if you don't have a student here. The truth is, I also don't remove books from my shelves, but I'm happy to listen to you complain about it and tell you why it's important that it's here. But, you know, back to our work group, and I actually do a lot of nonprofit work in other spheres of my life. And this is actually a really thoughtful, good way to go about it because, you know, you're talking, as you look at the leadership in ALA and in most organizations, it's a certain age bracket and it's a certain group of people that have, you know, come up kind of together. And so I think there's a lot of value in saying, hey, you are new to this space, new-ish to this space. And, you know, all of us there's 5 of us and we all are different kinds of librarians. We come from different parts of the country. I think it's really smart to pull together a group of people like that and say, what do you see that we can't see?
I love hearing you talk, Angela. It's why you need a podcast.
So just looking at the time here, is there anything that either of you want our listeners to know about the Emerging Leaders Program or your personal experience that we haven't touched on already?
I would just say, I know they do that application process. I don't know, it happens what, late summer, early fall.
Yep.
So if you are a librarian, I'm 3 years in, but this has been a really cool opportunity for me to get into spaces that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to get into. So if you're even, it's a great way to get to know the ALA, even if you don't eventually want to be in a leadership position, it's a really good way to kind of get your foot in the door and get an idea of what really is available to you through our professional organization. That's what the ALA is. So I would just encourage anybody who is interested in kind of furthering their career and understanding the resources that are available to them, apply, give it a shot.
Oh yeah. And it is deliciously diverse. I was taken aback when I walked into our first, like, what was it called? Not a cocktail hour.
But that's what it was.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's what it was.
It was like a meet and greet kind of thing.
A mixer?
Mixer.
Yeah. Mixer's good. See, cocktails. That's yes. Where we're getting there.
The mixer. But no, I was shocked. First off, everybody was so cute. Everybody had tote bags. But also, people of all ages, all types of stuff. It was just so refreshing, like, especially for me, being a person of color. I was like, oh, wow. Okay, we're doing this. We're doing this. This is so awesome. It's a nice kind of solidarity. Everybody's on the same page of, like, let's do this better. We're already doing good, but we can do so much more. So it's cool. I like that. And, like, I don't know. Personally, I don't get an opportunity to network with, like, a lot of newer librarians just because I'm here at my job. You know what I mean? Like, I don't get an opportunity to go to the library schools or anything. So it's a good time.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point too. It's a great, like, a lot of librarians practice in somewhat of a vacuum. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you have a few librarians that you work with, a lot of times it's just you, you know, it's not like it's a building full of librarians. So it is a really great way. You know, I'm a school librarian. So I met separately with all the school librarians that were emerging leaders. And we have this email chain where we're just sharing resources. If you've done something cool and innovative, or you did something that didn't work or did work. So now I have a wider net of people that when I can't figure something out or I need an idea for something, I have this group of people who are high flyers in my field who are doing cool stuff that I have a connection to. So it's been a really great resource.
I was shocked by the number of people who came up to me wanting my business card. And I was like, oh, wait, we do that here? We can just talk to each other. We can all be friends like that. And they're like, yeah, I want to email you. So coming back, I had like 20 emails to send, being like, it was so great talking to you. I hope I get to network with you again. We can go out for lunch or something when we're in California, like that whole jazz. So yeah, libraries rule. Librarians, we're kind of awesome.
That's a really good way to end it.
All right. So we wrap up the show with the segment I call The Last Chapter, where we talk about a library or bookish related question. So I thought I would ask you both, what author alive or dead would you like to meet and why?
So right now, if you ask me right now, it's Daniel Nyeri. I love the diversity of his work and I love how thoughtful he is, you know, from, like, They Both Die at the End is a very, very different book than The Seven Assassins of Samir, the Seller of Dreams. They're very different. So I love the breadth of his work. And I've been to a few of his panels and he's fascinating to talk to and listen to and the way that he approaches writing and the way he thinks about it. So if I could buy him dinner, I totally would.
Wow. Okay. So the last episode I was on was sort of a tier list episode. And my tier list theme was books that made me want to cry in 2023. Yeah, no, but they were all unhinged. They weren't sad. That's the thing, is that they were just all unhinged. This is like a common theme. I'm spiraling.
You're in your 20s. That's what we do in our 20s.
Exactly. And I'm like just going right into it. I'm just like, yeah, exactly. This is what I'm supposed to do, so it's okay. I don't know. So maybe like an author like Mona Awad, who's like all of her books are so weird and random and unbelievable. I just want to be like, hey, are you okay, babe?
Are you okay? Or,
yeah, like, let's talk about this together. Let's build a community. Or maybe like Ian Reid, that's another author whose books are all just super weird and time is not real. And yeah, maybe just like get in their head, because I feel like a lot of other authors that I know of that I would like to talk to are like known for being pretty like well reserved, but I would want to like really dig in there and be like, what's going on, babe? Let's talk about this.
I so. Love that you just want to take care of them, that you're like, I just need to check on them. That's really nurturing and lovely.
Thank you. My first thought was literally Olivia Blake, but I've seen and met her a couple of times, and she wrote the Atlas Six trilogy, and like, she's absolutely brilliant, but also like once you get her talking, she'll talk for like 20 minutes. But like, it's also that thing of like, I'd want to like pat her shoulder and be like, it's okay. Like one thing at a time. I've got a sticky notepad. Let's
deep
go
breath.
Through it.
Deep
yeah,
breath.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Exactly. But like she's already told me she loves me. And I'm like, dot, love you too. So no, definitely Mona Water, Ian Reid.
That's great.
Thank you.
I think previous times I've asked this question, I've said more of my like literary English major answer. So I think I'm going to, based on both of your answers, I think I'm going to say my self-indulgent answer, which is to meet graphic novel artist and author Lucy Ninesley. Yes. So she has written a handful of different graphic memoirs about her life. I think most people would probably be familiar with Kid Gloves, which was about her experience being pregnant, but also kind of dug into like the history of pregnancy and how we treat pregnant people.
It's not good.
A lot of it bad. Yeah, basically when men decided that they knew more about childbirth than women, everything kind of went downhill.
Let the women do the work.
Yeah, I know. We're all shocked by this. We're all shocked by this.
Did you know that they just, sorry to interrupt, but like you don't even have to include. Did you know they just started testing tampons with blood this past summer?
Yes. I saw that on Twitter before I stopped using Twitter and I was like,
I'm going to break glass.
Yeah, it's not okay. It's bad.
Anyways, go
ahead. Deadlock, everybody. Deadlock.
But so, like, that's the one that she's, I think, most people are familiar with. And I think her career kind of, like, took off then. But the one before that she wrote called Something New is all about her experience planning her wedding. So kind of, like, meeting her husband, but also just kind of, like, leading up to the wedding and the planning of it and her kind of like processing her feelings about weddings and about like how patriarchal they can be. Like there's a part in there about her being bi but like marrying a man and like kind of her feelings about that. And as someone who also is a bi person in an opposite sex relationship, I was like, that's me. You and me, we're in the same brain right now. We're having the same feels about the same thing. So, yeah, so I definitely have had a lot of moments of, like, very relatable while reading her stuff, and I kind of have a girl crush on her. So.
Yeah.
Love that.
Well, and I love that. I wrote those down because I haven't read those. I have heard of them, but, like, I think there's it's almost like diaspora, right, as a woman. Like, this idea of what it should be and having to deal with what it is and wanting, like I have children, I have a spouse, I have a very traditional looking life and how do I kind of line that up with my feminism and how I feel about women. And it's cool. But like my life looks very traditional because that happened to work for me, but it doesn't necessarily inform how I feel about the issues as a whole. So that's really cool. I'm interested to look into this.
Yeah. So trigger warning for Kid Gloves for traumatic birth experiences.
Yeah, they're often real terrible. So
She almost died.
Yeah.
Bad. So just heads up for that.
If that's a thing that is hard for you, maybe not this one.
After I read it, the head of youth services, she's the one who kind of told me about the book. And then I told her that I read it. And she was like, I hope it didn't like scare you too much about getting pregnant. And I was like, I mean, maybe a little, but also I'm a type of person that like knowledge kind of like alleviates some of my anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if you know what you're looking for, you have to advocate for yourself. That's a really valuable takeaway.
All right. So thank you both for joining us. And thank you everyone for listening. If you would like to reach out to us to answer our last chapter question or to reach out to the show, you can do that by emailing us at downtime@cranstonlibrary.org. You can also reach out to us via social media with the hashtag DowntimeCPL. If you're feeling generous, please rate and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts because it helps people find the show. Thank you again for listening. And this has been another episode of Downtime. Downtime is a project of the Cranston Public Library and is produced by Elena Rios, Robin Nizio,
and me, Taylor Cardillo. Audio engineering by Dave Bartos. Our theme music is Day Trips by Ketza. And our ad music is Happy Ukulele by Scott Holmes. Links to the books and movies discussed can be found in the show notes. Remember to rate and review Downtime on Apple Podcasts, connect with the podcast on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram with the hashtag DowntimeCPL, and if there's something you'd like to hear on the show, send an email to downtime@cranstonlibrary.org. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed are the speaker's own and do not represent those of the Cranston Public Library. The material and information presented here is for general information purposes only. The Cranston Public Library name, in all forms and abbreviation, are the property of its owners, and its use does not imply endorsement or opposition to any specific organization, product, or service. The content of this episode is the property of the Cranston Public Library and may not be reproduced without express written permission. Join us next week for more Downtime.
Not to go inside baseball, Dave will edit this out.